Stay tuned for Writers on Writing coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
KUCI. 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 KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
And good morning and welcome to this June 5th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. Stuart Onan joins me now, and I'll chat with Tara Conklin in the second half. Stuart Onan is the author of numerous books, including West of Sunset, The Odds, Emily Alone, Snow Angels, Songs for the Missing, Prayer for the Dying, on and on. His 2007 novel, The Last Night at the Lobster, was a national bestseller and a finalist for the Los Angeles Book Prize. Stuart has been on the show with me twice before, once for Emily Alone and once for Songs of the Missing. You can find links to those podcasts on my website, mariestone.com. This morning, we are returning to the Maxwell family, who we met with Wish You Were Here and again with Emily Alone. Henry himself is published by Viking, and we are going to chat about that this morning. Stuart, welcome.
Thanks, Marie.
So you have written a lot, like 17 novels across a lot of genres in a lot of styles. And before we dive into this one, I was just wondering if we could spend a minute talking about just your wonderful generation of ideas and your through lines maybe through some of these novels. And I don't know, whatever you can kind of offer about kind of your own creative idea generative process. And like, as you look across all of these, do you see, you know, they're all so different, but can you, I mean, obviously the Maxwell novels are not, but can you kind of see where some through line through all of them?
Well, yeah, and getting a little perspective, of course, from outside readers and editors and reviewers and things, that it seems that I'm concerned with endurance. I noticed in those early novels, Prayer for the Dying, Snow Angels, the characters who can't find the hope or the faith to go on and are somehow destroyed by it. And I see in later novels, characters who are facing almost equally dire circumstances find something they can fall back on, whether that's family or community or a sense of the world or the romantic in Fitzgerald's case, you know, or just, you know, some sort of, you know, codified or non-codified faith. They find a way to go on. They keep going despite everything.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about some of these, because you write, like I say, you write, you know, in kind of different formats and genres and things. Tell me a little bit about your process of kind of going through the world and scouting out ideas, because I feel like there are writers who look at every situation and think, I could make a novel about that. And then there are other writers who may have, you know, kind of one niggling idea that's plagued them for their whole life, and they keep just kind of writing around it. And I feel like you have found some kind of sweet combination between those. You have this family you're intrigued by, and you got all this other stuff going on too. So kind of as you walk through the world and look at it, does everything look like a novel to you, or how do you generate some of these ideas?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, nothing seems like a novel to me. I don't have a whole lot of ideas. I usually end up stumbling upon something, whether it's a situation or a character that is somehow mysterious and intriguing because I don't quite understand it or why people do that or how they do it. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, this one's it's Henry. He's 75, and we know from the previous books it's his last year of his life. So I kind of know what I'm walking into there. The last book before this was City of Secrets, which is about the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in 1946, a historical event. Mm-hmm. And so very different. But I guess in both cases, I just want to feel what it feels like to be this person going through this very peak experience, this very peak emotional experience, in some cases, peak physical experience.
Yeah, interesting. You, I don't know if we talked about this 10 years ago when you were on, but you were an engineer before you were a writer. And I always think it's kind of interesting to think about how careers feed one another and if there was, first of all, how that transition came about, and second of all, how, maybe being an engineer helped or hurt the writing life.
Well, I think, like most writers, I was bitten by the reading bug very, very early on. I've always been a huge, huge reader. And at some point, I think I just decided I'd cross that line, or I'd try to cross that line and try to write, and discovered it was very, very hard. And so when I was a young engineer, I was still trying to figure out what a story was, how a story worked, and why would the reader be interested in this. And so I'd be working in engineering, I'd come home and write stories in my basement, and go to the library and read and take notes on everything I was reading. And gradually, it began to sort of eat up a lot of my time, so I wasn't spending a whole lot of time with my family. Or we just bought a house. So I had a lot of other obligations, and I was kind of blowing them off just to write. And that's when my wife said, look, you should, you're spending all your time doing this. You should try to do this for a living. And I thought, well, that's just crazy. I'm going to, give up, aerospace engineering for, literary fiction. And at that time, short stories, which is just nuts. in the long run, I think it worked out. But for a while there, we were kind of, at loose ends.
Yeah.
But being an engineer means that you're very detail oriented, that you're a planner, and that you're also an observer. You're always looking for things. You're looking for how the world actually works versus the way you think it might work or that you want it to work. And in the end, the reality of the world always wins out. No matter what it says on paper, what actually happens, live in front of you in the experiment is what obtains. And in aerospace, everyone says there's no partial credit in space, which is absolutely true. So being detail-oriented, worrying about things, taking care of the small things, looking at component parts and seeing how they fit together and how they move, how they work, what effect a small thing has on another thing, I think that's helped me a bit in my plotting. On the other hand, I think there's a precision there that can be can really undercut your methods. So I write very, very slowly. I write not even word to word, but syllable to syllable, which is just not any way to compose a large piece.
Poet.
It's wonderful and it's awful at the same time, and it's just the way that I am, compulsive, always experimenting, always looking for something different, and trying to do better, I guess, trying to perfect things, which they're at odds, right? You're trying to blow things up at the same time that you're trying to perfect them.
Yeah,
which is kind of strange.
Yeah, that's interesting, and a lot of discipline. I would think engineers just have a lot of sit down in the chair and do it that I think a lot of other, writers who came to it from an English degree struggle with,
I'd say the opposite. I think engineers are, we bounce around. We want to find out about everything. And we're sometimes impatient. I think maybe being an English major is better for sitting in the chair. I mean, anyone who's had to sit down and read Finnegan's Wake knows you really have to sit in the chair. Whereas at least in test engineering, which I was, running around between the offices and the shop floor and the hangars and, the runways and just getting hands-on. When you're a test engineer, you get to do everything. When you're a writer, you have to sit in the chair, and you just have to just sit there. And that was, I think, the hardest thing for me to learn, was just to sit there.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So let's get into Henry himself. Last time we talked, it was Emily Alone. And so I'm going to let you kind of set the stage for Henry. And I assume, I don't know that our listeners know the Maxwell family yet. So I guess we could kind of do a global introduction of the Maxwells and how you got to Henry himself.
Well, Emily appears in the very first novel about the family called Wish You Were Here. She's going to a lake cottage, which she is going to sell because Henry has died and she can't afford the taxes on it, or she's afraid that she can't afford the taxes on it. So she wants to sell this sort of gathering place that the family has always relied on, summer after summer. And nobody in the family likes that. And so we get a week's vacation of her basically, you know, having to defend her position from the rest of them. 8 years later, I got interested in what's going on in Emily's life now. And so I wrote a book about her living by herself in Pittsburgh with her dog, Rufus. In both of these books, Henry has been gone, and he kind of hovers over them a little bit. He's a bit of a shade. In the first book, we have lots of point of view narrators, and they all have a different view of Henry, different take on him. In the second book, Emily, we have merely Emily's take on him, and a little bit of Arlene, the sister-in-law of Henry's sister. Mm-hmm. But we've never really had Henry from the inside. We don't know what makes Henry tick. Because everyone has a different view of Henry. And I decided, you know, 8 years after writing Emily, I'd go back and go back in time and tell Henry's story, since I thought, you know, he must be an interesting guy to be Emily's husband, because Emily, I think, is a very sort of fascinating character. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking about Henry, and the big question going into the book, Henry himself, was, who is this guy? Who is he? How did he become this person? And so I had to go all the way back to the beginning of his life and then tell basically his life story. And that's what I thought I was doing in the book. And the book opens with the line, his mother named him Henry after her older brother, a chaplain killed in the Great War, as if he might take his place. And so the bar is set for what Henry has to be. He has to be as good as noble as brave as devout as his uncle, who died young and was perfect, which very daunting, I think. And in trying to live up to that, Henry becomes who he actually is there. And I discovered in writing it and going through the drafting process, what I had written at the end was actually a story about the marriage between Emily and Henry, because Emily is so central to Henry's life, especially in this year that we're looking at, 1998. We do have all the backstory of, you know, his prior life and all his experiences, his war years, all that. But Emily has really changed him and made him into who he is. And so in the end, it turns out to be about their marriage, which was completely surprising to me.
I love it. So were you hemmed in or constricted by the other novels? Like, were there inconvenient things that you'd written Henry, you know, positions you'd written him into that you were like, oh, now he's kind of got to be this way, and that's too bad? I mean, you know,
No. In fact, the first thing I did when I decided I was going to write Henry was go back and read those first two books and look at all the little clues that I'd given myself about Henry. He is a consistent character, I think. It's just that everybody has their different take on him. Mm-hmm. And he was, I want to say, not vague enough, but he was sort of in the background enough that there was a lot of stuff that I hadn't really gone into on Henry. Mm-hmm. Plus, I have Emily's life as a guide. I mean, the life that he and she shared, she is still living in a way. Even after he's dead, she still thinks about him and talks to him in her head and still does the things that they used to do. She still lives in the same house. She still has the same dog. The only thing missing is Henry. So it was kind of a way of, I mean, sometimes when you're writing a novel, you look at the first half, especially if it takes a long time, you look at the first half of the novel to give you the clues for the second half of the novel. And in this case, I had to look at those two books to give me the clues for this book.
So it's nice that those books helped instead of hurt, that you were like, you know, there wasn't anything in there that you were like, now I'm kind of painted into a corner and Henry isn't who I thought he was, or, you know.
No. It was all a process of sort of, going deeper and finding that sort of that extension and finding the secret pockets that he wouldn't talk about with anybody else.
Yeah.
And this is about the interior life, finally. It's about what he can't say or won't say to the people closest to him and what he doesn't really understand about himself.
Right. So I'd love to do just like a little mini masterclass on character study because you're the master of you are the master of this.
Thank you.
I had a guest on 2 weeks ago who brought your name up and just raved and raved. We were talking about interior characters and some advice you had given to her about taking your characters out into the world with you.
Yes, wear the mask. Yeah,
walking around. So let's just do maybe a little MFA lecture on character study, if you don't mind, and kind of how you go about this. How you know is it? It sounds like it's syllable by syllable, but in addition to that, how you spend time with these guys, how you really got to know him. I know last time we talked, you were talking about using questionnaires, giving questionnaires out to some elderly folks that you had met and asking about their life. But maybe we could just talk about tips and tricks of getting to know characters.
Well, the most important thing for me is notebooking. So I will keep a notebook filled with just everything about this particular character, whether that's going to end up in the book or not. So words that character would use in their speech, and what is their idiom? Who are the people in the character's life? You can do what's called a character cluster, which is you put your main character in the center circle, and then every character that's close to them, you put them in another circle and look at the relationships, lines between the circles. And are there conflicts between these characters? In Henry's case, you have Henry in the middle, and you have Emily, who's probably an equally large circle right next to him. And the line between them, there's not a whole lot of conflict there. They kind of get along. They have some of the little sort of like the nitpicky things that couples have. But then you throw Margaret's circle in there, and Margaret's relationship with Emily is definitely conflicted. Mm-hmm. So on that line between the two, you can put a little, a little line across on it and say, okay, here's a source of conflict between those two. And then from Henry, the line from Henry to Margaret is weirdly almost incomplete because Henry has kind of cut himself off from Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from Emily's circle, looking at the line between Henry's and Margaret's, Emily looks at that line, that almost non-existent line between the two, and the line that she would draw to that line is heavily conflicted. Mm-hmm. Because she hates that they don't have a relationship. And then Henry can look back at the relationship between, say, Margaret and Emily, and there's a big conflict on his line to that one because he hates the way that Margaret treats Emily. That's one reason he's kind of cut himself off from Margaret. They're alcoholic, troubled, always complaining, always a pain in the ass daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, you say, where is the conflict? Where is the friction? You know, and how does that come out? Because in drama, that has to come out. I mean, drama is the feelings that we have for the people around us and the people closest to us. That's the most important drama. It kind of rules our lives. So that's one way to sort of get further, at least on the page, moving forward, saying, okay, what has to happen next? Well, those characters who are in conflict, they naturally have to either go out of their way to avoid conflict or confront the conflict and do it. And, of course, we know that the reader wants to see the conflict between the major characters on stage live right in front of us.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the temptation, is to deliver that all the time. And then you end up with something that's really screechy and almost like an Albee play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, and then you say, okay, how would they really treat each other? What would really happen in real life between these characters? So you get to know the character, you get close to them, you notebook them, you put on their mask and wear it out into the world. Say if Emily is going to a funeral or if Emily is going to a supermarket, and you're going to a supermarket, and you put her mask on and say, how would she see the world in a way that I wouldn't see the world? Likewise for a funeral or anywhere there. Gather up as many of these details as you can, be very selective, and then once you're writing these scenes, you say, the only thing I want to keep in this scene is what this character would remember, say, 5 years from now. Right, to try to get rid of those excess details. I mean, as writers, we all want to do the Ron Hansen thing, which is lovingly detail every scene so it's super live and vibrant and it's almost cinematic and movie-like. But for the sake of the reader doesn't need all of that detail. You know, only give the reader what they absolutely need to see rather than what you can see. as the writer.
Gotcha.
Or tie it in with point of view. So again, do it, be selective by memory there. And the same thing with, you know, the scenes that you're showing. You know, is this something that's indelible that is going to stick with your character?
And at what point, I'm sorry, you called it character mapping in the notebook? Is that what you said when you're drawing the circles?
Cluster, character cluster.
Cluster.
There.
And at what point do you do that? How much have you written when you start? I mean, I know you had the two novels before this, so this is kind of a different scenario. But if you were sitting down to write a novel from scratch, at what point do you start doing that sort of clustering and relationship work? Have you been writing these guys for a while and now you're kind of understanding who they are and how they relate to each other? Or do you do this before you even set out?
Well, usually I'll set off, I'll get hot on a character or a situation. I'll probably get 30, 40, 50 pages in manuscripts. And then I'll start thinking, okay, you know, does this thing extend? You know, is this going to be a big book? Is it going to be a small book? What's going on? What is going on with your character?
Yeah.
You know, what are they dealing with? And that usually has to do, again, with the people close to them. And that's when I'll do the character cluster to see where are the conflicts and not even knowing how they might play out down the road. But in a book like Wish You Were Here, which is, as my friend Luisa Reyes says, it's an epic about nothing. there's not a hard or heavy through line there, right? And so you have to give the reader some sense of both mood and direction. Otherwise, they'll just bounce. But you have to make sure that these irritations, particularly these conflicts between characters, are present and that we understand them from the very beginning. And that maybe we can see some potential for them, you know, moving or changing, you know, across this, you know, 700-page book. Otherwise, they'll get antsy there. So for a book like that, that is, it's done by the juxtaposition of emotion rather than that heavy through line or plotted, as we call it, or storyline. That's when I really do that cluster really, really hard and say, you know, what have I got going on here? You know, where are these misunderstandings with people? Where are the relationships that both parties wish they were better, but somehow they're not? And what prevents them from being better? Mm-hmm. And then I'll go back to that. There's a questionnaire that I'll give people, especially in a nonfiction class, when they're writing about their own lives, which is, you know, who are the five people closest to you in life? What about your relationship do you wish would change? What can't you say to them? If you said this to them, how would your relationship change? You know, and right there, ask that of your own characters in your work, and you know, get some interesting results.
I like these questionnaires, and I when we talked about Emily Alone, I know you were handing out questionnaires about how neighborhoods had changed and like what you lament about, you know, how life has changed around you and what do you miss and what do you long for and all of those things. And real life questionnaires given out to real life people would generate all kinds of stuff that you couldn't do in your own head because you're limited by your own imagination. So, you know, kind of gathering things for the nest, I think is a really cool idea. I'd never really thought of these questionnaires before you brought it up last time, but.
And you can't use all this info that you get, of course not.
Yeah.
But it also reminds you of how many things people have going on. You know, even in what we consider sort of normal, regular, boring, everyday, day-in-the-life, people got a lot going on. Everybody has a lot going on.
Yeah.
And that reminds you that you don't need, you know, the three explosions, each bigger than the other. You don't need that sort of massive rising action and falling action and climax and all that sort of stuff. You know, you can do just life.
Right, right. And what I was really interested in was how you take, like, somebody who has a lot of expected stuff. You know, you have a 70-something-year-old man who plays golf and he likes to putz around the house and he likes to, play with his dog and whatever, like think expected things.
Yeah.
But
he's the most exciting guy in the world, that's for sure.
Yeah, but then they're so specific that they're very universally felt and deeply felt while also saying, well, yeah, he would play golf. You know, like it's a really interesting juxtaposition of, I don't want to say cliche, it's not cliche, but it's just, you know, kind of the everyman against the so specific man that it just breaks your heart. And
Thanks.
I don't know how you accomplish that, but I guess you just have to be you.
Well, I mean, you have to have a good character too.
Yeah.
You know, and in Henry, I think I got lucky, and maybe in Emily too, and that they're kind of average people, but they're trying to do the impossible, right? They're trying to do right by everybody. They want to care about everything, every little tiny thing. And so they're very, what's the word for it? They're very susceptible to loss. Hmm. And they're susceptible to maybe not shame, but sorrow and regret. They're trying. You know, they're really trying. And that's a character that you want. You want a character who's trying to do the best for everybody.
Right, right. You earlier when we were talking about your notebooks, you said something about jotting down the language and the words they would use. So kind of developing their lexicon and just, I don't know if you have just strings of words that would be unique to Henry and unique to Emily. Is that what you do?
Yeah. Well, you're building an idiom there, right? And how that idiom traces but also influences his life. And it tells you so much about class as well, and class and position and geography, and you know, just language. You're gonna have to build his world out of language, so you're trying to find the language of his world to do it. And that language includes, you know, the people that are around him, and those are the people at church. What are their names? And their names are going to tell you, you know, what, you know, what social level they're at and what their history is as well. So you're saying, what is his world made out of? This goes back to that questionnaire, you know, name five places that you go to every single week, right?
Yeah.
Name five people that you know by name but don't really know.
Right.
And so you get all those social situations. When you're doing that language, all that social situation stuff comes up as well. And you can get that while you're doing sort of your directed reading. You know, if I'm writing a book about a single older man, I'm going to look at other books that people have written about single older men.
Right.
What's the Brian Morton book, Starting Out in the Evening?
Mm.
No, I'll look at that. When I was writing Emily, I was reading a lot of Mae Sarton. You know, seeing what people have done within this particular genre, and what are the cliches? You know, what are the pitfalls of it? What are the opportunities? What have people sort of overlooked?
Mm-hmm.
You're always looking for, you know, what to put in and what's next. And it involves a lot of legwork, I think, because again, you're going to have to be super selective. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to be just sort of like floppy and sprawling and messy.
Right.
I think I got a little bit of that in Which You Were. I think that was sprawling because every character suddenly seemed really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everyone was getting point of view section. I mean, even Rufus the dog had point of view section.
Right.
So in the case of Emily, in the case of Henry, we've got, you know, one point of view, and it really helps sort of narrow and unify both books.
Rufus is kind of the enduring character. I mean, I guess Emily is too, but Rufus... Rufus has stuck around.
Well, Rufus is a wonderfully enduring character because the damn dog's got to be 20-plus years old.
I was just going to say, Rufus is old.
No dog has ever lived this long. He was old when we met him in Wish You Were Here, which is, you know, 1999. And he was already sort of old and limping. But you know, maybe that's one of the liberties that I gave myself.
Yeah, I love it. So are the questionnaires pretty consistent from book to book? Like, would you ask the same of Songs for the Missing as you would of, you know, like, do the character questions you ask yourself change from book to book, or are they pretty consistent?
I think they would have to change. But, I mean... There's always another component of things I really have no clue about. Like in Emily, it was gardening. I know nothing about gardening. And I know gardening is very, very important to Emily. And so there was a whole sort of, you know, subset of questions on gardening that I handed out,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the people at the readings. In terms of Henry, I think Henry's a little closer because I've got my father and my grandfathers and my father-in-law that I can observe and talk to. So I have a lot of more first-person sources for that.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah.
It's very cool.
I don't know. I mean, every character, every person, every book, you know, is a complete and utter mystery. You start with that blank page, and you have to fill it all up and make it, you know, meaningful. And you hope emotional and moving. And so I try to get as much of this material as I can, so I have some sort of solid ground to stand on. And a lot of the research, I think, is also just for me. Mm-hmm. You know, these are just things that I'm interested in, that I'm just, you know, curious about. You know, and this is the job that I can indulge that curiosity to the fullest.
I also like that you stay very close to it every day. It sounds like you don't write a ton of words every day, maybe a page or 300 words, but you do it every day. And you know, you walk around in the world as these people. So you don't let them get too far away from you without touching base with them, you know, pretty consistently. And I feel like that also kind of keeps you connected and deeply in their psyche.
Well, that's also the fun of writing, is being there with the characters. You know, and going back every morning, and there they are again. There's the scene you've been working on. There's the world that you've been working on, and it's there, and you can sort of disappear into it. That's the joy of writing.
Yeah.
And that's the joy of reading, too, right? I mean, when you're reading something wonderful, like To the Lighthouse, you don't want to do anything else. You want to just be in that world with the Ramses. But you also want it to go on forever, you know?
Right.
You know, you end the book, and you're like, damn, this book's too short.
Right.
And so when you're writing the book, you know, you can take, for like with Henry's book, it took me 3.5 years. And I think that's partly because I just wanted to stay in that world. And the same thing with the Fitzgerald book, West of Sunset. And it was such a wonderful place and time to be, and great characters to be around, that I didn't want to leave it. And when I left it, I missed it so much.
Yeah. Not many people can say they want to be trapped in a 75-year-old man's body, but that's very good. Very good. I did. I didn't want to leave him.
I think it's his personality, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's a pretty good guy. You know, he has some of the drawbacks of anyone his age would have, or most people his age would have, you know, and where he is in society. But I think overall he is trying. And that's the character that you want.
He is a good guy, yeah. So your acknowledgement section has quite a number of readers. So it sounds like you rely on readers, you know, some core group. At what point do you hand this out to them? When you're really pretty sure it's very, very done, you kind of give it out to people and get their feedback? Or at what point does the feedback come to you?
Well, I get the drafts as far as I can possibly take them. So I'll finish up the draft work, and I'll go back and I'll do my revisions. I go back and back, you know, just compulsively. That's just me. I'll just pick and pick and pick. And I'll get it down to that slow bear moment when the comma that you took out last week, you're now putting back in, and you're questioning whether it should really be there or not. Or you can't remember, did I take that comma out? Did I put it back in? And you go back and you're like, yes, I've done this twice. This is dumb.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Then you say, okay, pull the comma out. Let's just go for speed, and we'll see if our first pass readers, you know, have any questions about it. And I'll go to the Kinko's. Well, not Kinko's anymore. Now I go to the FedEx, and how they took that over, I don't know. But I'll make about 10 to 12 copies bound, and I'll send them out to that first wave of readers. And I'll wait for, you know, 2-3 months for them to come back with their comments. And I trust, you know, all these readers. They've been reading my stuff for years and years. Trudy, my wife, you know, has read everything. And they'll come back and they'll give me notes on things, whether they're small or big, everything I want to know. And then I'll read those notes and I'll see whether I need to sort of fix things here and there, because you get too close. You know, when you're living with a character for 3.5 years, you get way, way too close. You can't quite see them with as much perspective as a brand new reader, a brand new set of eyes.
Right.
So I'll trust those readers. Then I'll go back and I'll make, you know, I'll blow some scenes up, or I'll cut some scenes, or I'll chain some things. You know, they'll find words that I've used like 7 times, and I'll be like, ah, I had no clue. You know, what am I trying to do there? And I'll question it. I'll say, hey, you know, if I'm using this thing, the same word 7 times, you know, why is that in there? Does it mean something? Is it a clue?
Mm-hmm.
Is it another clue that I can then follow on and do something more with, or do something less with? What do I want to do with it? What do I really want to say? So by the end of the revision process, you hope that you've gotten the book to where it's saying exactly what you want to say. You didn't know that this is what you wanted to say before you went in to write the book. But in the writing of the book, this is the process has taken you here to say, this is exactly it. This is what I want to say about this person, this place, and this time. And you said it as best as you can possibly say it. So after that first wave, I'll bring it back, I'll recut it, I'll send it out to a smaller second wave, and the second wave will come back. And usually they won't have a whole lot of changes or notes on it. But if they see something that I sort of agree with, and I'll cut it again. Then I'll send it off to my agent, David Gerner, who used to be editor-in-chief of Doubleday, and he'll have his view of it, too. You know, you never get rid of that editor in you.
Hmm.
He was also a poet, which is kind of interesting. You know, he came out of poetry.
That's cool.
So that's helpful. Yeah. He has a very nice ear. He's got great Catholic taste. Anything that I send him, he'll understand, and which is important. I mean, you know my shelf. It's all over the damn place.
Yeah.
Then we'll send it off to my editor, Paul Slovak, at Viking, and he has done everything. He's edited DeLillo and, Madison Smart Bell and just some, wonderful, wonderful writers. I think he had Toni Morrison for a little bit, too.
Oh.
He will have his take on it as well, and I'll look at his stuff. He's, again, wonderful guy with structure, good ear. And then we'll go to the copy editing. And the copy editor, even at that point, after me having gone through it several hundred times and these waves of readers and these other, the copy editor's still going to find things that are inconsistent or just flat out wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If one thing writing teaches you is how little you actually know. And, so book after book, I'm always amazed, how dumb I am. And every single person that sees the book and reads the book and gives you notes back is going to make it better.
Right.
It's not, me up in my attic by myself. It is everybody else as well helping me to get this character to a place where that emotional life of the character can come across to the reader in the most powerful way possible. Whether that means a very spare, light line or a very heavy line, it can be a Jamesian line versus Carver, and whatever means and whatever choices you made, you hope you made the right choice to get the character across, so that by the end of the book, in a book like Henry, the reader can say, "Wow, I really know this guy. I know this guy better than I know the people that I know."
Yeah.
And you hope that they will be able to say, "Oh gosh, this guy really reminds me of my father or my grandfather or my uncle or my brother," as an Emily. I always like to say everybody has an Emily. I hope that everybody has a Henry, too.
Yeah, right. That's so good. We're drawing down on our time. We covered a lot. Was there more we should have covered, or how did we do? Is there other advice that you could? You really did give the master class.
You did.
We got the master class.
For me, as a writer, I always wondered, what does the reader want? The reader wants things to be eventful. They want things to happen. They want things to happen to this character and see how the character reacts to it. And whatever, genre you're working in, they want that character's reaction to what happens to be realistic to who that character is. Now, whether that character is Frodo or Bilbo, we know that they're going to, react in different ways because they're just different people. And if we know them, then we understand why they act the way that they act.
Yeah. So good. Stuart Onan, the Bard of the Working Class. I didn't make that up. Somebody called you the Bard of the Working Class. I love that.
I think my editor made that up. And you don't want to be called a bard because then you get compared to this one guy who's pretty good.
Yeah, no, you do want that. It's pretty good.
Oh, no. They say, never quote a writer who's better than you within your book. Because immediately they'll just look at them and say, wow, why aren't I reading that guy?
No one wants to read more Shakespeare. I don't know.
we've
had enough Shakespeare.
Hey, just read Lear and just saw Lear. You can't. It's like Alice Munro.
Yeah.
You can't read enough Alice Munro. You can't read enough Chekhov.
You cannot. Yeah, that's right. Well, you can't read enough Stuart Onan. That's what I say.
That's
what my last guest said, too. She loved you. And I loved you. This was really great. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we can find you online. I can't remember. I mean, I went to so many websites. You have a website.
We have a website. It's www.stuart-onan.com. I think we're also a .wordpress.
Yeah.
I believe there's a Facebook page out there that Viking administers. I'm out there online. And, of course, my story with Stephen King A Face in the Crowd is out there online as an ebook only.
I wanted to talk about your collaboration with him, but alas, we'll have to have you back on, which we will.
Sounds good.
All right. Stuart Onan, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Marie.
Thanks. We're going to take a very short break.
Before turning to fiction, Tara Conklin worked for the International Human Rights Organization and corporate law firms in London and New York. She holds a BA in history from Yale, a JD from NYU School of Law, and a Master of Law in Diplomacy from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Her first novel, The House Girl, was a New York Times bestseller, a number one indie next pick, a Target book club pick, and has been translated into 8 languages. Her second novel, The Last Romantics, published by William Morrow, was published last February to wide acclaim. An instant New York Times bestseller, The Last Romantics, was a Barnes & Noble book club pick, an Indie Next pick, and was selected by Jenna Bush Hager as an inaugural read for the Today Show book club. We're going to talk about The Last Romantics this morning. Tara, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. So before we dive into the book, I'd love to talk sort of about this journey to becoming a novelist and turning away from the law. I was a lawyer once upon a time, so I'm always interested in this. And kind of how your legal background.
I already know the answer.
Yeah, right. But, you know, maybe just kind of how your legal background is either in conversation with the novels or perhaps at odd with them and you know, kind of that transition for you.
Yeah. My original game plan, you know, my elementary school, junior high school game plan was always to be a writer. But as I kind of progressed in my education and in my life, I realized, or I believed that being a writer was not a kind of practical career goal. Realistic career goal. I mean, I've said it. It's kind of like saying you want to be a rock star. That's sort of the way I felt about it, was that it was such a long shot that it was better to kind of keep it as something that I loved to do and that I kept doing all through, you know, the years of graduate school. And when I was working as a lawyer, I was still writing creatively that whole time. But I kind of saw it as something that I would do when I retired from the law. And, you know, I was a litigator in New York, a general corporate litigator, and then when I moved to the London office, I was doing international arbitration. And the majority of the work that I did was research and writing, which, you know, that was kind of what drew me to the career. So there were parts about the law that I did enjoy. It wasn't really, I mean, it was practical, but there were also parts of it that I liked for many years. But I got to a point both in my life personally and in my professional life where sort of a, you know, cut bait or fish. You know, it was like I had been in corporate law for about 7 years. I had 2 young children at home. I was at that point where you either kind of go for partner and start working or not start, continue working like 14-hour days, or you kind of stop. There wasn't, at that point in time, I think the legal profession is a lot different now, but when I was a lawyer, and particularly at my law firm, there weren't a lot of options for part-time work or kind of family-friendly hours.
Right.
So, and I had also started writing at that point. I had started writing what became The House Girl. And so I had, you know, this burning desire to actually see my children and this burning desire to write, to finish this story and turn it into a book. And so it was sort of, you know, I couldn't not do it any longer. And so I left the law. There are a lot of things about my legal training that have been helpful in writing. And I think, you know, there are a lot of, as you mentioned, there are a lot of lawyer turned writers.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I think, you know, I did a ton of writing and you do persuasive writing. And I mean, so much of fiction is persuading your reader to believe in the world that you're creating.
Hmm.
And that is very similar to what you do as a litigator. In your written submissions, you are persuading your fact finder to believe in the case that you're putting forward. Fiction is much more fun.
And there's a lot of discipline in the law that probably translates. I mean, it's very hard for a writer, I think, without a deadline to be disciplined. So that, you know, maybe some of that time discipline also applies.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was a lawyer, I'm sure you did the same. When you bill, you have to account for your time in 6-minute increments. So every 6 minutes I was billing to a specific client. And it really, I mean, it sounds horrible. It was horrible.
It is horrible.
But it does give you, it's horrible. But it does really give you a sense of the value of time and what can be accomplished in 0.4 of an hour. Like, you can get a lot done in 0.4 of an hour if you really sit down and do it. And so for many years, I still kind of thought in those terms. I was like, okay, you know, I've got 1.4 hours for kidnap time, and this is what I have to do. I'm not quite as disciplined now, especially now that my kids are in school, but it definitely, that kind of discipline really does help, because it is, I mean, as you know, like, being a writer, it's just this very amorphous kind of career, because no one, or very few people are really, you know, waiting. There's no one who really needs that next novel. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. There's no looming. Somebody made the point last week that there are 48 half hours in every day. And if you can't devote one of those 48 to writing, you know, come on, what's wrong? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Exactly.
Point. Good point.
Yeah.
So let's set the stage for, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's kind of tough love, but people often will say to me, oh God, I really want to write, but I don't have the time. And I always think, you know, you don't really want to write that.
Yeah.
Like, if you really wanted to write, you would cut out the Game of Thrones, or you would cut out the, you know, 45-minute chat to your mom, or you would cut, you know, there is so much fluff in even the busiest of lives. If you just sort of find 30 minutes or 40 or an hour, get up at 5, stay up late whenever you can fit it in. There are ways to do it.
Yeah. And I think it's less, I think time is the excuse, and shame might be really the reason that when you sit down and actually do it, because you do have the time and you read what you've written, it's so sometimes shameful. And, you know, you're like, well, if I had the time, I'd write the great American novel. And then when you try and do it, and you realize how difficult it is and how abhorrent the first drafts are. And you're like, oh my God, you know, I'm just so ashamed of what
You have to fight against your own taste, right?
Yes,
like, most people who want to write, most writers, they're, of course, they're first readers. And, you know, you develop a taste as a reader for fine books, or what, you know, whatever you love to read, and that's what you're trying to emulate. And of course, that first draft never looks like what you're trying to do. Sometimes the final draft never really kind of reaches the ideal that you have in your head. But you sort of have to learn to live with that if you want to get anything done.
Right. Well, let's
and you have to learn to rewrite.
Yes, correct. So let's get into that. I'm going to let you set the stage for The Last Romantics and kind of introduce us to the book so that we can jump off from there. Can you just kind of take us into it?
Yeah. So The Last Romantics is the story of the Skinner siblings. We have Fierce Renee, Dreamy Caroline, Golden Boy Joe, and Watchful Fiona. And the book opens in the year 2079. Fiona is a famous poet. She is 102 years old, and she's addressing a packed auditorium. It's her first public appearance in many years and is likely to be the last of her lifetime. And a young woman rises from the crowd and asks her to explain the inspiration behind her most iconic work, which is a poem called simply The Love Poem. And this is a question that Fiona has been asked many times before and has always refused to answer. But on this occasion, on this night, she
she decides it's time to tell the story. And so her answer is essentially my book, The Last Romantics. Mm-hmm. And she takes us back to her childhood in the 1980s in Connecticut. And there is a family tragedy that befalls the siblings. And then it takes them through their into sort of young adulthood. And then another tragedy happens to the family. And this tragedy threatens to really pull them apart. So it's the story of their relationships. And I like to think that ultimately it's a story about love.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the point of entry for you as writer, not necessarily the novel itself, but what grabbed you in the beginning? Was it a character? Was it an idea? Was it these relationships?
Yeah. It was an idea. It was an idea that was inspired originally by something that happened within my own family, my own extended family, about 15 years ago now. And when this event happened, it just prompted me to ask a lot of questions about sort of the strength of love relationships and the limitations of love, and why people often betray those whom they love the most, and just kind of the kind of idealist view of love. And I'm not talking necessarily romantic love. I mean, any mm-hmm. love relationship, whether it's a partner or a parent or a child or a sibling. And this book focuses on sibling relationships. But at the time, it was more just this kind of amorphous idea of both the limitations to just how love is actually experienced by people, and how we grow up with this, particularly women, grow up with this idea of like this idealized, you know, the knight in shining armor will come down and rescue us, kind of the Disney princess model, right? The old Disney princess model that I grew up with in the 1970s and 1980s, mm-hmm. And just how that is not how love really operates. There isn't a happily ever after. It's work. In whatever, whether it's romantic or not romantic, a love relationship is a responsibility and it's an obligation. And it is also wonderful and gives meaning to life, but it's not all, you know, rose petals and fresh baked cookies. So that was the idea. And I also really wanted to look at siblings. My dad is one of six. He's from a big Irish Catholic family. I am one of three girls. I have three children myself. I have a ton of cousins. And I've always been really, really fascinated in how sibling dynamics, how they operate. And watching my kids and kind of their shifting loyalties and kind of how they bounce off of each other and boy-girl dynamics. And yeah, it's just, I just find it fascinating. And so I wanted write a book about it.
So interesting. So when you start with this idea of love, which is such a big thematic concept, like I wonder at what point that comes in. Because if you think I'm going to sit down and write a book about love or loss or grief, it's no, it's good.
My dog. Freaking out.
No worries. But these big ideas are like it's hard to then take the novel and say, okay, you know, we got to get it down to a scene level. We got to get it down to the concrete.
Yeah.
And I was wondering kind of at what point, like, is it when the book is finished and you're like, oh, this really was a book about love and relationships, or if it's, I really am going to set out to write a book about love, but I have to start with, you know, this, kids playing out by a pond. That's where it starts, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for me, for this book, for me, and this is certainly not the way it was with The House Girl, and it's not the way it's going with my work in progress now, it was definitely the idea. But the idea was inspired by an actual event within my family.
Yeah.
And the character of Joe, the brother, is based very loosely on a real person. And so he, so that his kind of conflict and his sort of image of, again, it's looking at sort of the image and the ideal versus the real and the like under the, you know, if you, you know, open the closet and you get out the dirty laundry, you know, like what's really in there. And, yeah. And it was, and, you know, Joe is a character who on appearances, he seems like he has it all together, right? He's this very successful, handsome, charismatic, charming guy. And people love him. People naturally gravitate towards him. He seems to have this very strong network of friends and family. And there's no reason why a guy like this in 21st century America can't get it together, you know, like there's no reason that, you know, on the surface why he can't be successful and happy and satisfied with his life. And yet within him, he's deeply, deeply unhappy and feels deeply empty. And so that he was the first character. And it was sort of this, you know, the idea of the siblings, the limitations in the relationships of these siblings. Cause when they're children, you know, their father dies when they're very young and they form these incredibly close bonds and they think that these relationships will sustain them for the rest of their lives. I mean, they're like this little, you know, they're this little team, the Skinner kids. But there are limitations to what you can do and to the help that you can give to someone, even if you love them absolutely. You know, there are always, you can't save someone, I guess, is really, is sort of what yeah. the book is sort of one way of looking at the story of Joe.
Right.
But the idea was there, but it was based on this real event and the real person was the loose inspiration for that character. And then the sisters, because I knew I wanted to write about siblings, I kind of went through a lot of drafts of figuring out who these women were, who the sisters were. And then the story kind of followed from there. But it was definitely the kind of progression of the novel was idea, one character, four characters, and then the plot.
That's super helpful because we always talk on the show, you know, about the outliners versus the pantsers. And, I think, you know, the authenticity really comes through pantsing and not outlining. However, if you don't have some sort of unifying principle out there of what the book is about, you're just going to write all of these scenes that a lot of stuff happens, but nothing really, you know, gels it all together as one cohesive idea of a novel. And so I love this, that the big idea came first and then one character, but you always had something that you were writing towards and because of, so that the scenes were all hanging off of that clothesline of the theme of, you know, the limitations of love.
That's
helpful.
I did write, though, just to be clear and to be brutally honest, I wrote a lot of scenes that were not that were cut. I mean, I wrote this book three times, and really, really struggled in those first two drafts with finding a narrative and an arc that said what I wanted to say and really provided, you know, an interesting story for the readers. I mean, I think this is a problem with books that start with an idea, is that you get so enamored with this idea and you forget that you're telling a story, you know? And I definitely did struggle with that. in the early draft. I mean, when I say I wrote it three times, like I handed this book into my editor as a finished product three times. And the first time she said, "This is a great first draft," and I was like, "But no, I've been writing this for 2.5 years. Like, this is not a first draft." She's like, "No, this actually is a first draft." And then the second time she said it, you know, she was like, "We're getting there, Tara. We're getting there."
Does that first draft look familiar to you now, or is it just totally different?
It's totally different.
Okay.
Yeah, it's totally different. Okay. It doesn't have the pause, which is the whole first section where of their childhood. That did not show up until the final version, the third draft.
Gotcha.
The third manuscript.
Okay.
Which I think is really key to those relationships.
Right.
I mean, I remember I was workshopping pages of this book. I'm pretty sure it was either in a writing group or a class. I'm pretty sure it was in with my writing group and or a group that I met with several years ago. And someone said to me, "Gosh, but why are these siblings so close? Like, why do they care?"
Uh-huh.
And of course, I'm very close with my siblings, and my dad is very close with his siblings. But not everyone, you know, obviously not everyone has those relationships. I mean, I know many as adults, I think siblings are often become estranged. And so it didn't really click with me that I had to really go back and look at why they cared so much about each other, why they were so close. It couldn't just be a given that because they're related and because they're brother and sisters, they're naturally close.
Right. Right.
And that was a really key kind of insight into the characters for me.
And you're wonderful at maintaining suspense throughout, you know, that you lay down all of these crumbs. I think the middles of novels are really very difficult because that's where, you know, attention starts to drag. You've still got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
the kind of characters have been set out, but how do you keep maintaining suspense? And you do that in a number of really interesting ways. One, moving across time, moving across space. Laying down different obstacles, you know, and I think that's hard too. I think middles are really difficult in sustaining reader suspense and dropping, you know, just kind of enough clues to keep the reader going. There's one point in the novel when it could have gotten dry, you know, when some question had been answered for the reader, and, you know, so working yourself over that hump. I don't want to give it away, so I hope you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. yeah, I do know what you're talking
you know,
about.
You know, to pull the reader
you.
Over the
thank
humps.
Thank you for not giving it away.
But pulling the reader over those mountains, I think, is difficult for novelists. And I don't know if you have any insights on that.
Yeah, I mean, I as a reader, I want to have a reason to turn the next page, right?
Yeah.
Or to go on to the next chapter. And so I am very aware of providing that in my books. And so it's definitely something that I think about and when I'm writing. And it's not, you know, I think when you use the word suspense, because it is, you're right, it is suspense, but I think a lot of people think it has to be like a thriller kind of suspense, like who's the killer, that it has to be some big dramatic question, but it doesn't really. It can be a question of a relationship. It can be a question of a personal, you know, revelation. It can be, but if the reader cares about the characters, those kind of moments and those kind of questions are just as suspenseful as the car chase, you know, through the city.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you establish those characters as real people, and people that your reader are going to care what happens to them, then your moments of suspense, you know, can encompass so many different different kinds of situations.
Right.
But I am definitely, I'm glad, thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
That is one thing that I do try hard to do, is to keep, you know, give the reader a reason to keep reading and to turn over to that next chapter.
I assume all of that happens in the revision process. In the third round of the novel that you now have everything laid out, and then you kind of backfill all of the, you know, here's a opportunity for me to leave a clue to the reader, or here's an opportunity for me to generate suspense or generate a reason for them to turn the page. I mean, that's kind of stuff I think would be difficult in the first draft, although maybe in the first draft, that's where the surprises happen for you, the writer, who kind of doesn't know what's going to happen next. And, you know, maybe those are clues, you know, that where you were surprised gives you an indication, here's where I can provide some surprises for the reader.
Yeah, definitely. That's very well put.
Okay.
Because the clues, I mean, unless you're not, and I'm very much not an outliner. So I'm never quite sure when I sit down to write the first draft what's going to happen. And that for me is just grand adventure of writing, and I love it, and it makes me a less efficient writer. It means that it takes me longer to finish a book than an outliner. I'm always just amazed by people who, you know, are writing like a novel a year, or I just, you know, it's that my hat is off. But having those moments of surprise as I'm writing is so satisfying. And then, going back in later drafts and putting in clues and leading up to that surprise. Yeah. But I really think that everything comes from character. I mean, you know, if you try and force something into the story that doesn't naturally come from these people and the conflict that they are experiencing, it's going to feel false, you know?
Right.
And I mean, that
right.
definitely has happened to me. I'm trying to think of an example. You know what? No specific examples from my drafting are coming to me right now. But I definitely know that, like, there have been, I'll be like, oh, God, wouldn't it be so great if, you know, Renee falls and breaks her leg in the snow, and then her daughter comes out and finds her, and, you know, like, but, Renee, you know, first of all, Renee doesn't have a daughter, but secondly, that would never happen. Like, Renee would not fall and break her leg. She's a very sensible person, and she would be walking very slowly in the snow, and you know, so you have to really focus. For me, I feel like everything comes from the characters, and getting the characters first just naturally leads to the kinds of suspenseful moments and the kinds of conflicts that make a story true.
Right.
And interesting.
Right. I also think when the conscious mind takes over too much to say, let's generate some manufactured suspense here that I'm going to just come up with, like a car chase, that somebody told me last week that, like, filaments or lint of cliches just start attaching to that idea, and it just devolves into one big predictable cliche that when you're too much manufacturing what's going to happen to people, it just starts to fall apart. And that feels right. That feels
right. I agree.
Yeah. I also want to talk
and
about
I
your,
always hate the oh I just to follow up quickly on that. Yeah. I always hate that writing advice that I've read before and I think even have been taught before. You know, you have to throw up obstacles in front of your character. Like, you shouldn't be, like, manufacturing these things in your character to get through, right? Like it should be coming from the character and from the place where they are, both in life and geographically, and the, you know, what would be a conflict and what would be an obstacle for them. It's not like you can throw a tornado at somebody, you know? Like,
yeah,
I would say that, like, now you have to throw up obstacles. Like, it's this external thing. I find is not good advice.
That's really, yeah, that's good advice right there. I think that happens maybe more in genre fiction, do you think? Like romance novels and mysteries and, I think you're right. That maybe those genre novels are more plot driven and literary fiction is more character driven. I don't know if that's a good way to delineate it, but yeah, interesting.
That seems to be how it, although I've read plenty of, you know, technically, you know, labeled genre fiction that is really good.
Yeah, right.
Know, that,
yeah,
like, for
right.
me is very character-y. And so I, those labels, I think, are sometimes, I mean, their publishers come up with those labels,
yeah,
right?
Right.
They're trying to sell the book, and it's easier for them if they can put a label on it.
True. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I also want to talk a little bit about your point of view, because it's so liberating and wonderful. And I don't know if you call it, I was kind of thinking of it as like almost first person omniscient or something. So it's really Fiona's story because it's that, you know, the cloak around the book is that she's telling us this story, but it would be very limiting if that were the way it was. So we need access to these other characters and what happened. So it's a lot of first person Fiona, but then third person other characters. And talk a little bit about that, if that was, if it presented any challenges, if it just came about organically, if you got any, if you would call it first person omniscient.
I guess I would call it first person omniscient. I mean, I haven't really thought about what I would call it, but yeah, I think that's probably a good description of it. I mean, yeah, it did come about organically, because, and the frame of Fiona telling the story from the future was also something that came kind of later in the drafting process, because I realized that I wanted to write this family epic. I wanted to cover a lot of time in these characters' lives, but I also wanted to look at women of my generation, and I wanted it to be a story that had contemporary issues and contemporary conflicts. And those two goals were opposed. Those were two kind of narrative goals that just weren't sitting well with in the previous drafts, because I had this kind of nostalgic tone, this kind of looking back tone, which just didn't seem right for a story about contemporary women. So it was literally like a kind of an aha moment of, wait a second, what if Fiona is talking to us from the future? And it, you know, I could sort of have my cake and eat it too. You know, I could look at women now, but I could also have this really wide sweep of the characters' lives. And I also just thought it would be fun. I had never read a book like that before, and I just thought it was a really fun kind of way to tell this story.
Yeah.
And so from that, it just, the idea that Fiona is our narrator and she's recounting these stories, it just kind of flowed naturally that, you know, she, first of all, she's a creative person. She's a poet. So this is what she does. You know, she tells stories about anything and about specifically her family. I mean, this has been the prime inspiration of her life, or these relationships. And so it just seemed, of course she's going to, you know, talk about their interior lives and their interior thoughts. And I kind of like that, you know, it's like, is this really what, you know, what Caroline was thinking, or is this, you know, because also remember, Fiona's 102 years old and she's telling the story. Her siblings have passed away. So she's recounting, I mean, presumably she's had conversations over the years with her siblings about these moments. So I just like that. It just offers so much possibility, to really get into these other characters and get into their heads, but maintain that immediacy and that voice of Fiona.
It does. It does. And I really had wanted listeners to, who feel confined by point of view or flummoxed by it or whatever, to take a look at this, because it does offer another way. You know, we always think, well, it's going to be a first person or a third person story, and those are our choices. And it really is a little bit more expansive than that. And, you know, you really can get creative with point of view in some really cool ways that give a lot of possibilities to the book. So that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, I'm glad that you liked it. I have had one reviewer be very dismissive of it and say that I was breaking the point of view rules.
Oh, sure. Of course. Of course you did.
Laid out in, you know, and that, you know, how could Fiona know what was going through? What was going through Caroline's mind at that time and how?
Right, of course. Yeah, there's always the one.
But but I'm glad that it seems that most readers are with me.
Yeah, for sure.
They get it.
Yeah, they make there's all sorts of leaps in fiction, and point of view is yet another one. So it's for sure.
Yeah.
We're drawing down on our time. I hate this. But
are
there words of advice or wisdom or other writing stuff that has particularly sustained you, or that you learned through the process of writing this novel three times?
I mean, I would just say, you know, keep writing. I mean, it's a, you know, all of those pages and all of, you know, those failed drafts, were not, I mean, they were failed novels, but they were not wasted. It was not wasted time or wasted words. And that was how I got to know these characters and how I figured out the story that I wanted to tell. And so I think, you know, every page that isn't working, every draft that you throw into the trash, you know, that's what you need to do to get to the story that you want to tell. And don't be discouraged, because, you know, you're getting closer.
Right.
Every word every word that you rewrite, you know, you're getting closer. And I do think, you know, it's this weird, I feel like writers are this weird, you know, breed of type A perfectionists. Like, in order to write, I mean, writing novels is hard. It's hard work. And in order to do it, you have to be kind of a perfectionist who will, you know, devote 5 years. I mean, not everyone takes 5 years to write a book, but this one took 5 years. And, you know, you have to be a certain amount of stick-to-itiveness.
Masochist,
you know, perfectionist, masochist, to sit in front of your computer for that long. But then at a certain point, you also have to say, okay, and this, again, it's kind of the taste issue. Like, I love Ian McEwan, and is my goal to write as well as he does, but you have to let it go at a certain point.
Yeah.
You can't be such a perfectionist that you never finish, I guess. You have to accept some compromises, and do the best you can.
Well, I think that's what,
I
think you're getting at the heart of what we started the interview with, which is writers making excuses that I don't have the time to do it, because I think what they're really saying is all of this stuff. It's super hard, and it's super humbling, and it's super mortifying, and it's super, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It's easier to say, I don't have the time, than it is to say, wow, I actually really suck at doing it, because I did.
Yeah.
I did it, and it's really bad.
Every first draft, I mean, Jennifer Meehan, I remember she was talking about the shitty first draft and like how, I was like, God, even Jennifer Meehan has shitty first draft.
Yeah, like, right.
That it's just part of the process, and you have to go through it. And it's getting words on the page, because words on the page you can work with. Words in your head, you can't do anything with those.
Right.
So,
and it is good to hear all the writers who have, the famous writers who have failed. Like, I heard Joyce Carol Oates and David Foster Wallace were commissioned to write something for, I forget which magazine, probably The New Yorker. And they did it, and they were like, well, they were asked to do it. They did it, and they were like, it's not good enough. Like, we're not publishing that. It's not. It's not up to our standard. And it's nice to hear that for, the common man to hear. You know, it's hard for everybody, and regardless of your accomplishments, sitting down at the page is just the first time you're sitting down at the page. So
yeah. And I mean, this goes to also, like the vocation of being a writer, like the everyday reality of being a writer, you have to enjoy the process, find something to enjoy in it. Because I think everybody wants to have written a book,
right?
You know,
right.
Like, yeah, it was really, you know, and it, but it takes a while, and it is a lot of trial and tribulation, and you have to really enjoy that process. And I love it. I mean, I am a masochist. Like, you know, I mean, it's horrible, and it's demoralizing when you hand in your book that you've been writing for, you know, a while to your editor, and she tells you that it's not good enough, you know. But I really just love creating characters, and I love finding out what happens to them and developing stories. And, you know, you have to enjoy the process. If you don't enjoy the process, then it's, then do something else.
Boy, that is true. That is so true. Yeah, if you're not enjoying what you're doing and you're just doing it for the end product, just hang up your hat.
It's not
worth it.
Yeah.
Tara Conklin, this was awesome. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, thank you. This was so fun. It was nice to chat with you.
Tell us before we sign off where we can find you online.
TaraConklin.com.
And are you still doing, are you all done with your book tour, or are you still going?
I have a few events. I'm going to be in Nashville in the fall, and I've got a couple things in Seattle. I'm going to, in June, God, I can't remember the date. It's up on my website.
Okay.
But in June, there's an event in Seattle with Lori Frankel, who's another who's a fantastic Seattle writer, and a friend of mine, and she's just really funny, and we're going to have a chat at Folio Athenaeum. It's a place
I've never been before, but I've been thinking
to go there. It's a relatively new space
in Seattle.
So that's happening.
I love it. So we'll check out your website, TaraConklin.com. That's great. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That is all the time we have for today. Deborah Eisenberg will be on next week. So until next time, stay tuned for more awesome programming, more great music on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.